Physicians, technically beholden to no clan, but skilled at channeling therapeutically, were rare and in high demand. Hilo had had Dr. True, the staff physician at Caldew Academy, pay a few visits to Tar. Technically, that wasn't allowed by the hospital, but no one was going to argue. "I'm gonna marry your little sister," Hilo told him. "Lon agreed, so it's official in the clan. I'll take good care of her, I promise." Tar said, "You know I'd follow you anywhere, whether you married Wen or not, right? Just get me out of this hospital already." "I know," Hilo said. "Relax while you can. I'll be needing you plenty as soon as you're out." It was plain that Tar was bitter about being wounded and away from the action, but Hilo didn't feel like assuaging his fist's ego or talking business. "You have a good suit?" he asked. "You'll need to look good for the wedding." Hilo was, at least, pleased and relieved that after the attempt on his life, Wen had quickly acquiesced to living on the Call estate. "I'll move into the main house," he'd reassured her, though the thought of rooming down the hall from his grandfather made him grimace. "You'll be in the Horn's house. You can do whatever you like to it. New carpet, new paint, whatever. Spend what you like. The money doesn't matter." "Yes," she said, her lips pale and firm, her face weary from nights spent at the hospital by Tar's bedside. She glanced around her small but tidy and well-decorated apartment with detachment, as if she was ready to leave at once. "You're right. Now I know how badly our enemies want you dead. My pride isn't worth the risk of them using me to hurt you." Having gotten his way, he felt grateful and affectionate. He gathered Wen into his arms and kissed her face many times. "There's nothing for you to be ashamed of," he said. "We're engaged now. I asked Lon. He gave us his blessing. Call Make Wen. Don't you like the sound of that? We can plan a wedding, a big one. Pick a date. I was thinking soon. Springtime, what do you think?" Wen wrapped her arms around his ribcage and held on to him so tightly that the new jade studs dug into the still tender flesh of his chest, and he laughed at the discomfort. She said, with little expression, "Lon is a good peacetime pillar, but he's not a commander of fists. There's no one else with enough jade and respect in the clan to be a strong wartime horn in your place. The mountain knows that without you, Lon will have no choice but to give in to them. That's why they're clever to want to kill you first, and why they'll try again." Hilo frowned. This wasn't the discussion he'd hoped to elicit after sharing the news that they were to be married.
"Let the fuckers try."
He cupped Wen's chin to look into her eyes. "Are you worried about being a young widow, like my ma? Is that why you're not excited about the wedding? I'm excited. I thought you'd be excited."
"Should I be? Womanishly thrilled about dress shopping and banquet planning while others plan the murder of my fiancé and my brothers?"
"You don't have to talk down to me like that," Hilo said, irritated.
"I'll always have enemies, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be happy. You have to trust me, Wen.
If anything happens to me or to Ken and Tar,
you'll be taken care of, I promise you that. I'll make sure everything I leave is in your name. You won't even be tied to the clan like my ma was if you don't want to be."
Wen was silent for a moment.
"Now that I'm going to be part of the family, there's no reason why I shouldn't work in the clan. Ken and Tar are your first and second fists. You could use me, too. Put me somewhere in No Peak where I'll be of help in the war when it comes."
Hilo shook his head.
"This war is not for you to worry about."
"Because I'm a woman?"
"Because you're a Stone Eye," he said.
"This is between green bones."
Wen let her arms fall to her sides and stepped back, opening space between them.
"I come from a green bone family. You said yourself I have the heart and mind of a jade warrior."
"That doesn't make you one."
Hilo was disturbed by the direction this conversation had taken.
"You know I don't believe the bullshit about jade bringing people closer to the gods, or Stone Eyes being bad luck, none of that.
But if you're not a green bone, then there's a different life for you,
Not better or worse, but not a Greenbone's life. You can do anything else you want, but not this. Other clans have made use of their Stone Eyes. Stone Eyes can move freely through the city. We can handle Jade without giving off an aura. You told me that Temben the Carver is a Stone Eye from the mountain and does their bidding still.
A sense of terror and rage rose and coated the inside of Hilo's nose and mouth.
You're not anything like Temben, he said in a low voice. Temben is a puppet. I'm gonna follow every one of his strings back to the mountain and cut them off. He's a dead man. You will never be like him.
He seized Wen by the arms so quickly that she didn't even have time to flinch. He was aware at all times of how slow and soft she was, how vulnerable, how easily he could hurt or break her. And the thought of her in peril from his enemies, other Greenbones, filled him with a fear he did not have for his own life.
The mountain will do anything. They'll recruit common thieves. They'll send a Stone Eye to smuggle inside No Peak territory. I suppose next they'll send children against us. I won't do that. I won't send a Stone Eye into a Greenbone war. I won't ever use you like that. Nothing will change my mind on this. Understand?
He shook her.
Yes, she said meekly.
He softened and enfolded her again with a sigh. I think maybe you're bored at your job. Wen worked as a secretary at a legal office.
You're too smart for that kind of work. After we're married, you can quit and do what you want. Want to go back to school? You could do that. Or you want to start your own business doing interior design type stuff. You're good at that for sure. We can think about it.
Yes, Wen said. We can think about it more. Later.
Surely a talk with the weatherman's office would provide Wen with a number of good options. The clan had lantern men with connections in almost any field one could think of. He was not about to approach Doru, though. He would wait until Lan had the old pervert ousted. Then he'd speak to someone like Hame Tumashan. He needed to speak to Shay again as well. He hadn't seen or spoken to her in weeks. As someone who was open and expressive with his emotions, Hilo had long harbored the vaguely resentful suspicion that he loved his family more than they loved him back, and with no one was this feeling more pronounced than with his sister.
How could Shay be so cold?
It bothered Hilo more than he let on.
Had she come back to Kaycon merely to make the rest of them feel sorry for her? To punish them with rejection? Clearly she was suffering self-esteem issues, what with the way she continued to inflict jade deprivation on herself as some abnormal form of penance. He thought that perhaps he'd been too hard on her, said hurtful things at one time, as if she hadn't done the same. And that was one reason she'd run off to Aspenia. But he was ready to forget all that. They were both adults now. They were calls. They had responsibilities. The three of them had to stand together if they were going to keep No Peak strong. Sometimes he felt as if he was the only one who could see that clearly. If he talked to Shay again, and if Lon would stop handling their sister with kid gloves and back him up, he thought he might convince her of his sincerity and get her to ease off her aloof and intransigent position. Not that he had seen much of Lan lately either. Their conversations on the phone were frequent, but brief and tactical. What was happening, what needed to be done. Hilo instructed his fists to kill any other gangsters caught thieving on the docks. Elsewhere, he shored up his clan's defenses. He promoted Ian, Obu, and a few other senior fingers to fists, and reassigned territories to more effectively protect No Peak's most valuable areas and holdings. He went around the city, personally visiting and reassuring all the lantern men. "Keep your moon blade sharp," he told his warriors. Mountain Jade was theirs for the taking if they came across the opportunity. His spies compiled as accurate a report as they could of Gaunt's organization, how many fists and fingers he commanded, where they could be found, which ones carried the most jade, and were most formidable. Studying the list, it was apparent to Hilo that while strength of numbers was roughly comparable between the two clans, no peak was at a disadvantage. The core swath of the clan's territories bordered enemy-controlled districts to both the north and south. The mountain had eliminated two smaller rivals in the past couple of years, and their greenbones were on average more experienced fighters. Hilo needed more warriors. Next spring, an especially large cohort of new greenbones, including his cousin Andon, would graduate from Caldew Academy. But until then, Hilo mused unhappily, he would have to make do. Theoretically, the clean-bladed duel at the factory between Lan and Gom Oben had preserved the peace, but in truth, it had merely given both sides an opportunity to regroup and consider their next moves. Even though the clans were not officially at war, Hilo was certain it would not be long before the current skirmishing and harassing escalated into outright bloodshed. Hilo also had no doubt that the mountain would not be discouraged after only one failed attempt on his life. He was rarely home anymore, and thus had to remain constantly on guard. Sometimes after a long night, he parked in a shady spot he felt was safe, stretched out in the back seat of the Duchess, and napped while Ken sat watch. Being the horn had become entirely too much work and stress. Chapter 26. War Maneuvers. Every seat in the long boardroom of the Ship Street office was taken. A dozen lantern men of No Peak, the presidents and executives of some of the country's largest companies, had come to hear directly from the pillar and to question him about defensive measures and security for their operations. While disputes over territory and businesses were not uncommon, the prospect of outright war between the two largest clans in the country was unprecedented, and it had the crowd of businessmen in a state of considerable consternation.
Will projects that have already been granted the clan's patronage be allowed to continue on schedule and as planned?
Asked a real estate developer Lan recognized as one of the lantern men he'd met on boat day. Doru bobbed his elongated head.
Currently, all initiatives that have been approved and funded by the clan will continue to be supported.
Will greater security measures be taken to protect our business properties?
Asked a lantern man who had several retail locations in the armpit. Lan said, "The Horn has been taking steps to ensure that clan territory is defended. Priority will be given to districts where the threat is greatest."
What about the possibility of the mountain disrupting commerce? They control much of the trucking sector. Might they not attempt to lock us out and make it difficult for us to deliver goods?
Asked a man with a furniture import business.
And what of sectors that will be hurt by the drop in tourism?
Interrupted a hotel owner.
Does the clan plan to do anything to support the hospitality industry?
Lan stood up. The murmurs running around the table ceased.
I cannot guarantee there will not be any impact on your businesses, he said. We are being threatened by another clan and have to be prepared for difficult times. What I can promise is that we will defend ourselves. Every part of the clan, every sector, every business.
This seemed to make an impression on those gathered. The pillar noticed their gazes lingering on all the new jade he was wearing, the irrefutable proof that he'd recently been victorious, that he could back up words with force. Lan cast an assessing look down the table.
I'm afraid we can't address every question at this time. If you have additional specific concerns, make an appointment to discuss them with the weatherman and myself.
Enjoy your afternoon, gentlemen.
May the gods shine favor on No Peak, some of the lantern men murmured, saluting as they exited.
When they were all gone, Lan turned to Doru. I would like you to go to Igudan, he said. Doru adeptly masked any surprise he felt.
Is that necessary, Lansa? Surely it's important that I remain in Jianlun at this time to help you deal with the Lantern Men.
We can put off additional meetings with the Lantern Men for a few weeks. I want you to find out what you can about the mountain's shine-producing operations in Igutan. Where are their facilities? Who are their suppliers and distributors? How much business they're already doing? Pull every string we have in that country and do it quietly. We need to know where our enemy is investing. It might be information we can use against them in the future if we need to.
Doru pursed his thin lips.
Perhaps he sensed an ulterior motive. Ever since the duel at the factory, Lan had been guarded around the Weatherman, and Doru surely understood that he was out of favor, but Lan did not want him to suspect anything beyond that. Allowing some of his true anger to show, the pillar said harshly,
I need someone I trust to do this, Doru-Jen. I wouldn't send anyone less capable or discreet. We've had our differences lately, but we can't afford to have any doubts come between us right now.
Will you do as I say from now on or not? If not, I'll accept your resignation as weatherman.
You can keep the house. I wouldn't make you move. He saw that he'd gambled correctly. The old advisor relaxed a little. Surely if the pillar suspected Doru of treachery or meant harm to him, he wouldn't show his emotions like this. He would be careful to pretend to reconcile and keep him close.
Doru was reassured. He said quickly,
You wound me, Lansa. I've disagreed with you only out of concern for the clan and for your safety. You're right, of course. We must find out more about the mountain's operations in Igutan. I'll leave tomorrow.
Lan nodded and said, sounding mollified, I appreciate your concerns, Uncle Doru. I need you now more than ever. I'm sending two of the Horn's men with you to Igutan. It's not a very safe country, and gods forbid anything should happen. The faint smile that had begun to crawl over Doru's mouth dissolved at this news. He guessed at the truth. Lan did indeed want information about the mountain's operations in Igutan, but more importantly, he wanted Doru out of the way, watched constantly by Hilo's men, something he could not accomplish here where Doru held sway on Ship Street, surrounded by his own people. He wasn't worried about Doru's activities in Igutan. Hilo's men would report back regularly and would corroborate everything Doru discovered. There was nothing the man could do against the clan. Lan's outburst of pique had disguised any other negative intent Doru might have perceived, and having already agreed to go, the weatherman could not disagree with the pillar's security measures.
Whatever you think necessary, Lansa, he said.
As soon as Doru was on a plane, Lan asked Woon to arrange an urgent meeting on short notice with Chancellor Son Tomorrow and 25 other members of the Royal Council of Kaikon over an invited lunch at the Grand Island Grill and Lounge. The Grand Island was on the penthouse floor of the 28-story Eight Skies Hotel in upscale North Soto. The lantern man who owned the Eight Skies closed it to other customers at Lan's request. The pillar arrived early with Woon and greeted each of the councilmen as they arrived. News of the duel at the factory had been all over Jianlun, and everyone Lan met these days noticed and remarked on the new jade he'd added to his belt, the cuffs on his wrists, the cord of beads around his neck. If it weren't for the immense importance of public perception right now, Lan would have resisted wearing all the acquired jade. The injury he'd sustained from absorbing and repulsing Gom's channeling attack lingered and made it hard to bear the heavy load. He'd been to Dr. True for healing sessions and wasn't feeling as ill as he'd been immediately after the duel, but he wasn't feeling well either. Sometimes his heart would begin to race, or he would break into a dizzy sweat. Anxiety flared without warning. His sleeplessness worsened, and he was often edgy, off-kilter.
Far do your enemies flee, Kaljen.
the councilman said as they arrived, voicing the traditional expression of congratulations given to a recently victorious Greenbone.
By the luck of Genshu's favor, Lan replied, thanking them before inquiring,
How's your wife's health, Mr. Loyi? Or, Mr. Nur, did your house fare all right in the typhoon?
These 21 men and 4 women were the most senior politicians loyal to No Peak. They came from longtime Lantern Men or Greenbone families and owed their political and financial success to the clan. Together, they held significant sway over the 300-member Royal Council of Kaycon. After a 2-hour-long, no-expenses-spared lunch of mango coleslaw, fire-breathing soup, and grilled octopus, during which no business was discussed, Lan motioned for the table to be cleared. He began by commending Chancellor Sohn at length for his far-sightedness in proposing the recent bill to reform KJA ownership laws.
The No Peak clan completely supports the government's wish to ensure that the stewardship of Kaycon's jade is balanced and transparent. I'm grateful to be able to count on the clan's friends in the Royal Council to do what is right for the country.
Chancellor Sohn beamed and waved a fat hand modestly as the other council members tapped the table in applause. It was all in politeness, as everyone in the room was surely aware it had been Lan himself who had instructed Sohn to take such steps. Lan let the applause fade, then said, somberly, Unfortunately, I must make you aware that these efforts come too late to rectify wrongs that have already occurred. He explained that he had brought them here so they would hear it from him first and directly. He would be exercising his co-directorship powers to suspend the activities of the Kaycon Jade Alliance, bringing all mining operations to an immediate and indefinite halt. The clan had discovered significant financial discrepancies between mine production and treasury records, he said, and given the importance of jade to the nation's economy, security, and identity, mining could not be allowed to continue until an independent audit was conducted. He strongly urged the Royal Council to call for and administer one as soon as possible. Operations would not recommence until the problems had been identified and the KJA reform bills passed to ensure future oversight. Sohn Tomorrow was the first to break the stunned hush that followed the pillar's statement. The Chancellor leaned his heavy elbows on the table and cleared his throat loudly, in a way that Lan could tell was meant to express the man's disappointment that he had not been personally consulted before such a drastic decision.
With all respect, Carl Chen, why is this the first time we are hearing about these accounting discrepancies? And why then is the weatherman not here to explain them?
The weatherman is away on other important clan business, Lan said, answering the second question and ignoring the first. Lan could not have discussed his intentions with Sohn earlier without risking Doru getting wind of them, unless he'd revealed to the Chancellor his unproven suspicions of treachery within the leadership of the clan, something he would absolutely not do with any Lantern Man, no matter how senior. If Doru was indeed a Mountain collaborator and complicit or responsible for the discrepancies Shay had discovered, by the time he returned from Igutan, it would be too late for him to halt an official investigation into the KJA's books. The long-faced councilwoman Nur Uma asked the question on everyone's minds.
Are we correct to assume you believe the Mountain Clan is behind this?
Lan gestured for the servers to refill the guests' teacups. He didn't drink from his own steaming cup. He'd been running a slight fever since last night, and hot liquids made him sweat too profusely in public. Yes, he said. That's exactly what I believe.
I find it difficult to believe that the Mountain is unilaterally manipulating the jade supply so egregiously behind the backs of the council and the other clans, said white-haired councilman Le Yi Tushara with obvious skepticism in his voice.
I would believe it,
said Nur, who had family members on both the business and military sides of the clan.
But Ait Mada's representatives will surely deny any wrongdoing. What do you hope to accomplish with this audit, Kol'jen?
The clans depend on the support of the people as much as the people depend on the protection of the clans. It has always been this way, Lan said. The nation will not want one clan to become too powerful, to control more jade than all the others. If it comes to light that the mountain has acted against the good of the country, public and political opinion will turn against them. The results of the audit will lend urgency and credence to the Council's goals of passing stricter oversight over KJA activities. Lan stopped to take a surreptitious, focusing breath. He'd abstained from eating much lunch, but nevertheless, he felt tired and mildly woozy. It was an effort to keep his attention entirely on controlling this important conversation. Fortunately, it was relatively easy to fool jadeless councilmen. They mistook his moments of weakness for authoritative pauses. For years, Kaikon has been fortunate to enjoy stability and economic growth, Lan continued. We have foreign investment. People drive nice cars. Our cities are booming. All things that my grandfather's generation couldn't have imagined. At the heart of this wealth and security is jade, which means that the clans who control jade must be held accountable. The councilman nodded. This was a point on which they all could agree. One of them, Vang Hajuda, began to say something, but Lan's perception began playing tricks on him. It turned abruptly white with background noise. The individual energies of the people in the room, combined with hundreds more on all the floors beneath them, all the way down to the thousands more walking on the busy street and driving past in the cars outside, all crowded into Lan's mind, unfiltered, interfering with one another in a sudden cacophony of nonsense, like a bad television signal blaring static. Lan's head throbbed with pain. He felt, for a second, as if he were dangling high in the air atop a column of nothing but meaningless energy babble. Under the table, he gripped one of his chair's armrests, hanging on to its reassuring solidity. Lan turned away and brought a hand up to shield his lips as he leaned over to Woon, sitting directly on his left.
"Pretend to be telling me something," he whispered.
His pillarman bent next to his ear worriedly.
"Is it really bad this time, Lan Zhen? Do we need to make an excuse to leave?"
"No," said Lan. Sweat had broken out on his brow, but the moment was already passing. The feverish confusion of his jade senses receded. His perception settled and grew focused again.
"Just tell me what he said. He wants assurances there won't be more bloodshed."
Lan straightened to face the table, just as Vong finished asking a question. "I apologize for the interruption," Lan said. There was a minor ripple of consternation down the table. They were watching him closely. Vong repeated himself with a touch of pique.
"If we bring these issues you've placed before us to the Royal Council, can we count on you, Kol'jen, to try to re-establish the peace between the clans? No one wants violence on the streets, frightening people and driving away foreign business."
"We all want peace," Lan said. He let his words hang as he wetted his mouth with a bit of tea. "Unless our families are attacked. Then, we do what we must." A number of the councilmen murmured in agreement. They were a strange breed, these politicians. As representatives of their districts, they pressured the pillar for peace, but as clan loyalists and true Kekanese, they would never respect a leader unskilled or hesitant in dispensing violence. Lan killing Gom and wearing his jade gave them confidence in him as a leader and confidence in No Peak's assertions. They would return to Wisdom Hall and work toward the purpose he'd set them.
"We understand perfectly where you're coming from, Kol'jen," Vong persisted.
He represented an area of Jonlun that included the contested territory of Sogen.
You've always come across as a reasonable man. But what about your horn? Does he also want peace? Can we count on him to also be reasonable?
Lan laid a flat stare on Vong.
The horn answers to me.
Admonished, Vong fell silent. The pillar drew his gaze slowly up and down the long table of faces. When no one questioned him further, he rose from his seat.
Stay as long as you like, my friends. Enjoy the tea and the view.
He nodded toward the expansive windows looking out over the downtown skyline before turning back to the table.
Chancellor, Councilman, your friendship to the clan and your service to the country are, as always, deeply appreciated.
Once in the elevator, Lan mopped his brow and leaned against the wall, exhausted. He'd kept it together, but just barely. Dr. True had told him that his key, the essential aura-producing energy of each individual that could be amplified and manipulated by contact with Jade, was damaged like an overstrained muscle. It might be weeks, even months, until it fully recovered. Lan did not have the luxury of months. He couldn't afford to continue like this, with his Jade tolerance and abilities handicapped, not with so much at stake.
Woon, he said, putting a hand on the pillarman's arm. I've always been grateful I can trust you. I have to ask something of you now that you must keep to yourself. You can't let it slip, even within the family.
Woon regarded him with concern.
Lan Zhan, I'll do whatever you require of me.
Lan nodded.
I need you to make a phone call.
Chapter 27 Mistakes Revealed. Shay sat quietly in the back row of the slow bus to Morenia, staring out the window and avoiding conversation, while the tourists chatted and took photos out the open windows all along the scenic coastal highway. When she arrived in town, she found her mother walking on the beach behind the family's cottage. Her mother seemed neither surprised nor especially excited to see her. Perhaps Lan had called her already to tell her to expect Shay's visit. Kal Wan Ria embraced her daughter warmly but briefly, as if she'd last seen Shay a month ago instead of more than 2 years ago.
We can stroll the beach and then have some tea, Shay's mother suggested. If we walk an hour that way, there is a very nice tea house. The owners are very nice.
These days, she told Shay, she took long walks, gardened, watched television, and attended a class in watercolor landscape painting at the community recreation center. Shay ought to try it sometime. It was very restful. The seaside town of Morenia held 10,000 inhabitants and was a far cry from the ceaseless activity of the city. Shay found that it was just what she needed to set herself at ease again, to escape the confusion she'd felt after being around her brothers, who were, she knew, now engaged in a clan war without her. In the evenings, Shay practiced alone with the moonblade behind the cottage, the long expanse of wet sand, a spongy black sheet under her bare feet, the roar of the ocean replacing the hum of traffic from her balcony in Jonlun. In the morning, fresh fish stands sold the dawn's catch, surfers rode the warm swells, and people said hello to each other in the streets. No one was a greenbone. It was like when she'd been in Aspenia. What a disquieting revelation it had been to live in a place that functioned perfectly fine without Jade and without clans. The two things that all the men in Shay's family worshipped, that she'd been taught her whole life to hold above all else, other places did without them. Clan patronage and settling disputes through duels were seen as backward things. Greenbones were thought of as something exotic and magical, but ultimately archaic and savage. It was Gerald, really, who'd opened her eyes to the wider world.
Sometimes Shay was not sure whether to thank or blame him for it. 2 years abroad had given her a perspective on her home country that she doubted most Greenbones possessed. Her college friends in Aspenia could never understand Kaycon. They would be bewildered by its apparent contradictions, by the seamless blend of modernity and casual brutality. Shay found Mirenia charming, but her mother's company depressing. Call One Rhea was like a piece of artwork or furniture that had blended in with the rest of a house and went unnoticed. Before she'd been married off, she'd received a basic education and enough martial training to be able to tolerate jade contact, but not enough to actually wear or use it. After her husband's death, she deferred to her father-in-law and later to her eldest son. If she begrudged her place, it never showed. If she found her life now to be dull or lonely, that didn't show either. Shay watched her stirring a pot of soup on the stove. Her mother had put on some weight, and her hair was graying.
"The boys are always very busy," Rhea said over her shoulder. "Lan comes to visit me sometimes. Hilo, only once. To show me his girlfriend. A very nice, polite girl, but a stone eye."
Shay's mother tugged on her right earlobe.
"Still, it's his choice, so long as he's happy and his brother agrees."
She turned the stove off and moved the pot to the table.
"They've been in fights, did you know that? Both of them. Hilo, of course, always fighting. But Lan said he had to duel as well because of the disrespect to the family. So unfortunate."
She clucked her tongue as if the pillar and the horn of No Peak were small boys who'd been implicated in a schoolyard brawl. No doubt Lan sanitized the things he told her, but still, Shay wondered if her mother preferred to be willfully ignorant about what was going on in the clan, or if growing up during wartime, she'd long ago accepted such violence as the casual norm of all men.
"I made it extra spicy, the way you like it," said her mother, ladling out the soup. "I've heard the food in Aspenia is not very good. What did you eat there?"
Her mother listened as Shay told her about Aspenia. They discussed superficial things like the food, weather, and clothes. Call Juan Rhea didn't ask about Gerald. She didn't inquire as to why Shay had returned or what she was doing now. She did not even remark on Shay not wearing her jade, other than to sigh,
"Ah, you worked so hard for it before, as hard as the boys. I'm glad you've learned to take it easier now. It's better for your health not to always be working so hard. As long as your brother doesn't think it'll look bad for the family."
As a general rule, she avoided asking prying questions or expressing strong opinions. As a child, Shay had gone to her mother for comfort, but never for advice. Indeed, she could think of little she had in common with her mother besides their eyes and somewhat mannish hands.
"Do you like it here, Ma?" Shay asked. "Are you happy?"
"Oh, yes," said her mother. "You and your brothers are grown up. There's no need for me to be around Greenbone troubles anymore. Men cannot escape it, of course. It's in their nature. But you took off your jade and went to live far away, so you understand."
She was not sure she did. Even now, she couldn't say if she'd run toward Gerald and the enticing modern world beyond John Loon, simply to escape the sting of her grandfather's displeasure, the humiliation of seeing him, for the first time, openly side with Hilo against her. On top of his extreme ire over Gerald, Carl Sen had been furious to learn of her involvement with the Aspenians.
"At least whores only sell what belongs to them," he'd raged.
He'd never spoken to her in such a way, had always been kind and approving toward her, even when he was stern. Only a few years out of the academy, she'd been young, arrogant, and disaffected, and not thought her actions to be harmful. Gerald, when he came to understand her family's position, had introduced her to some other Aspenian military personnel who were eager to ask her questions. At first, they were simple questions that Shay knew the answers to or could discover easily through the clan's connections. The Aspenians were keen to expand their political and economic influence, but they were uninformed about how things worked on Kaycon. They wanted to know, which clan leaders comprised the board of the KJA? When did they meet, and who held sway over the jade export decisions? Who on the Royal Council was responsible for military spending? How could they secure a meeting with this person, and what sort of gift would be appropriate to send? What they were most interested in, however, were their enemies. Igutan, less advanced, but with vast land and population and growing military strength, was the one rival the Aspenians seemed to fear. Even here, on a small island so far away, they were on the watch. They wanted to know what investments Igutanian companies were making on Kaycon, how much jade the clans believed was being smuggled to Igutan through the black market. Could Shay ask around and find out why a certain supposed Igutanian businessman was on Kaycon? Where was he staying, and who was he meeting with? The Aspenians were constantly appreciative. She did not need the money they gave her, but Aspenians always paid for favors so they were not indebted. That was their way. Shay was more impressed by the student visa they agreed to arrange for her so that she might study abroad. An Aspenian education was something few people on Kaycon had. It would be even more impressive than graduating at the top of the academy, would set her above and apart from her brothers. In the meantime, she was helping ignorant foreigners do business in Kaycon, and in truth, she took a secret pride in it. It was something outside of the clan that was hers entirely. Information and relationships that belonged to her, not her grandfather, or her brothers, or Doru.
"How can you call yourself a call, you selfish idiot girl?" her grandfather had demanded. "Anything you tell the foreigners might be used against the clan."
The Torch had wielded all his considerable influence, had made angry phone calls to the Aspenian ambassador, who gave apologetic assurances to Kal Sen that his granddaughter would not be approached by anyone from the Republic of Aspenia's military or intelligence services again. Gerald was shipped back to Aspenia, and Shay, burning with the indignity of Granda swooping in to set her right, had followed him. She'd been a fool, but sadly, even fools were entitled to their pride. Shay returned to John Loon feeling calmer and more rested, but also determined to rededicate herself to the job search and find meaningful employment as soon as possible. There was really nothing, she mused, that motivated her quite as much as the abiding fear of becoming like her mother. If she had her own work to occupy her, she wouldn't spend time the way she spent it on the bus ride back to the city, speculating on what Lan and Woon would do with the damning financial information she had furnished them, or wondering when the mountain would try to kill Hilo again. She got back to her apartment and groaned aloud to discover that she'd left her keys on the kitchen counter at her mother's cottage. She was locked out of her place. Shay left her bag sitting in the hallway by her door and went over to her neighbor, Khan Yu's, hoping to use his phone to call the landlord. No one answered when she knocked. There was a pile of flyers in front of the door that suggested Khan had been absent for several days. She went back outside and climbed the metal fire escape stairs, intending to force a way back into her own apartment, but upon passing her neighbor's window, she stopped and stared. Khan's apartment was almost empty. It was clear that no one lived in it. There was a small television on the floor and a telephone sitting on top of the television. There was a sleeping bag and a couple of cushions on the floor, but nothing else. No furniture, no clothes, nothing on the walls, no sign of Khan himself. Shay began to tremble with suspicion and outrage. She pushed open the window and clambered into her neighbor's apartment. It was laid out almost exactly like hers. She walked into the kitchen and found that the cupboards were empty, except for a bag of peanuts and a sleeve of crackers. The fridge contained only a few bottles of soda. Khan had supposedly been living here for as long as she had, nearly 4 months, but he had never moved in. Shay went into the bare living room and sat down on one of the cushions to wait. She suspected it would not be long before Khan made an appearance, and sure enough, perhaps an hour later, the front door opened and the young man walked in, his accumulated junk mail gathered under one arm. He stopped in astonishment when he saw Shay sitting inside his apartment. Before Khan could recover his wits, Shay got up and moved past him, shutting and locking the door. Turning around, she drew her talon knife and advanced. The young man backed up, licking his lips nervously, his eyes on the knife. His back touched the wall. Shay reached up with her free hand and pulled off the black skullcap Khan always wore. The man's short hair was messy and flattened, and the tops of both ears were pierced through with jade studs. Not much jade, not enough for her to notice an aura unless she was touching him. Shay took a step back and pointed to the phone. "Call him," she said. "Tell him to come over here right now." Khan picked up the receiver and dialed, his eyes darting fearfully. Shay doubted it was her or her knife that made him anxious. It was his boss's reaction he was worried about. "Helogen," Khan said after some minutes of being passed around on the other end of the line. "It's Khan Yu. Your sister, she told me to phone you. She's holding a talon knife on me and wants you to come over here." There was a moment of silence, and then Shay caught a snatch of her brother's laughter coming from the other end of the phone line. More words were exchanged, and then Khan hung up. "He says he's finishing up something, but he'll come soon." "Security, was it, Khan-jen?" Shay said. "You work in security. In a rather boring job, if I recall. One you've been hoping to get out of soon." "I didn't mean it in that way," Khan explained, reddening. "It's not that I think you're boring, it's just that keeping watch over you isn't all that exciting, you know." "No, I don't suppose it would be." Her sudden, odd sense of hurt and amusement came out as a cold smirk. "And here I was, starting to think all our meetings were because you were working up to hitting on me." "Touch the horn's little sister?" Khan let out a nervous bark of laughter. "Come on, put the talon knife away. Don't you think you've pulled it on me enough lately? It doesn't seem very charitable, considering that I'm supposed to be protecting you." Khan seemed to be in a surprisingly good mood. He was smiling broadly now, the hair freed from his skullcap falling into his eyes in an irritatingly handsome way. Shay suspected that Hilo's reaction on the phone had reassured Khan that he was not in as much trouble as he'd feared, and now he was looking forward to the end of this undesirable assignment. Shay sheathed her knife. "So you've been camped here, following me around?" "I'm supposed to watch you when you're out and about." He nudged the sleeping bag on the floor with his foot. "I used to slip out the window in the evening and be back in the morning before you left, but now the horn says I have to be here whenever you are." Khan backed into the kitchen and came out with a sleeve of crackers and two bottles of mango soda. "Do you want some? It's all I have, I'm afraid. Or we could go wait in your place instead." Shay gave him a dirty look, and Khan shrugged, opening his soda. Hilo arrived perhaps 20 minutes later. He knocked on the door and called cheerily.
"Shay, you haven't hurt poor Khan Yu, have you? I told him there were risks involved with this job."
When Shay flung open the door, her brother stepped inside, smiling, and made to give her a hug. She shoved him back violently.
"You've had me watched and followed all this time," she hissed.
Instead of answering, the horn straightened the shirt Shay had rumpled and turned to Khan, shaking his head. His voice turned harsh.
Gods in heaven, this was the easiest job a finger could get, Khan. Where and how did you fuck up?
Khan's smile vanished at once.
I don't know, Helogen, he stammered. The doorman called to say she'd returned from Morenia. I came straight here, but she got into the apartment and was waiting for me when I arrived. I'm sorry I failed you.
The young man bent into an apologetic salute.
Hilo sighed deeply, looking around the bare apartment. It's hard to fool my sister for long, but you should have done a better job of it. Go report to Mate Ken. I'm sure he could use you in the docks. You might even get a chance to earn some green over there if you concentrate harder on not fucking up from now on.
He opened the door in dismissal, and Khan exited quickly with eyes lowered. Hilo did not lose his stern expression, but he gave the finger a single pat on the back as he passed, and the young man glanced up with a nervously grateful expression. In one unfortunate instant, Shay's perception of Khan transformed. Her friendly, attractive, next-door neighbor was just another one of her brother's many underlings. She was bothered by how much it aggravated her that Khan did not even spare her a parting glance as he left the room. Shay wheeled back on Hilo.
Stay out of my life!
You're flattering yourself, Shay. I need every finger I have right now.
You think I wanted to waste one of them on guard duty over you?
I told Lon it was your choice to live here without Jade and you could goddamn take care of yourself. But after what happened to Andon, he insisted that you be protected. Don't blame me.
Lon told you to set a guard over me?
Shay was taken aback. Hilo having her watched made her nearly speechless with ire, but she had never known Lon to be anything but prudent and well-intentioned. Some of her anger diffused into uncertainty.
What happened to Andon?
Gaunt Ash snatched Andy out of Summer Park on boat day, took him to Eight, and made a show of trying to turn him while offering us a sham alliance to make and sell Shine and Egoton with them. They gave Andy back, but they made their point. They shook us up, and they insulted Lon. He turned them down flat, so they tried to take me out of the picture, and here we are.
Shay shook her head. She didn't want to admit to being unfair to either of her brothers, particularly Hilo.
I didn't know about Andon. No one told me.
Hilo gave an incredulous and condescending snort.
What do you expect, Shay? You came back to John Loon, but you're living out here jadeless like you want nothing to do with us. You made me search you out in a hotel and then treated me like a stranger. You haven't gone to visit Andy. You haven't seen any friends from the academy. You didn't even go out of your way to come over and pay a bit of respect to Tar when he was in the hospital. You've never once invited me into your place, not even now when we're standing in the apartment next door. What's that supposed to mean, huh?
There was true bewilderment and hurt in his voice.
What are you even doing these days, anyhow?
Shay felt her temper rising anew.
I spent weeks doing that work for Lon, remember? And I've been applying for jobs. I have interviews coming up.
Interviews, Hilo repeated with dripping disdain.
For what?
You're gonna work as a suit in a bank?
Why?
I don't understand you, Shay.
Shay's face burned.
I don't need your advice, Hilo.
Or your protection.
No, you didn't. Never before. But now we're at war with the Mountain, and you're still acting like you've nothing to do with any of it.
You're ignoring that you're a call.
Hilo advanced, his face tight, his voice edged with a vexed desperation.
I've got news for my tough little sister who thinks she's too good for her family. Lon won't come out and say it, but I will. You can't be an ordinary person, Shay. Not in this city. Not in this country.
You don't like being kept in the dark, secretly guarded, and treated like some helpless woman?
Well, you put yourself there.
There had been a day, almost 10 years ago, Shay remembered, when she and Hilo had squared off, spitting fire as they'd done many times before, and realized at the same moment that they were both wearing jade now and could fatally harm each other. They had stayed themselves on that day,
and it was perhaps only this memory and the knowledge that Hilo was wearing a great deal of jade and she carried none that kept Shay from launching herself at her brother now. "Say whatever you want to Lan," she said, her voice cold to hide all emotion. "But I don't want to see any of your men around my apartment or following me ever again. Risk your own life how you like, Hilo, but leave me alone to live mine." She caught a glimpse of her brother's stricken expression as she pushed past him out the door. She remembered, only at the last minute, that she was still locked outside of her apartment, but too proud to be seen struggling to get inside, she left the building and sat in misery at a tea shop down the street until it was dark. When she returned, Hilo was gone, but the landlord was waiting for her, holding her bag and a spare key.
"Carl Jen said to make sure you returned home safely, miss," he said, saluting her solicitously. "I must apologize profusely for not realizing who you are. Please, from now on, if there is anything you need, you should call me directly."
As he unlocked Shay's door, he turned over his shoulder and inquired,
"Are you sure you're quite comfortable here? I have another property, a new one, only 10 minutes away, run by my son-in-law, where the units are much larger. The rent would be the same for you, of course." "No?" "Well, don't hesitate to let me know if you change your mind. My family and I have always been friends of the clan."
Chapter 28. Deliveries and Secrets. Andon had a bad feeling about the errand the pillar had sent him on. It was simple enough. Lan had phoned him to inquire when his next free afternoon from the academy would be. He wanted Andon to come see him. Could he please stop by a certain address on the way over and pick up a package and bring it to his cousin? Andon agreed, of course, but this was now the second time Lan had asked him for the same favor, and that seemed odd. The pillar had any number of subordinates he could send to pick up parcels. For him to ask Andon once might have been random convenience. Twice made Andon suspect he'd been singled out for the task. The address was for a walk-up apartment just down the hill from the academy, at the edge of the Crossyards district. When Andon rang the doorbell, a man in baggy camouflage pants and a yellowed muscle shirt opened the door.
"You again?"
He had green eyes and might have been a Spenian, though he spoke Kekanese without an accent. Andon couldn't decipher either the graffiti-style tattoos on his arms or the jangling music coming from the interior of the apartment. It was not particularly uncommon to see foreigners in John Loon, and becoming less so all the time, but encountering them always caused Andon some discomfort. He knew that must be how he looked to those around him. So he did not greet this man with anything beyond a polite nod.
"Wait here."
The stranger closed the door, leaving Andon standing awkwardly on the landing. A few minutes later, the door reopened, and the man handed Andon an unmarked white padded envelope. Andon took it and zipped it up inside his school bag. Lan had told him to keep it out of sight, not to open it, and not to tell anyone about it. He rode his bike to the transit station, where he caught the bus to the call home. That was another thing. There were faster methods of delivery than a student with no car. Andon could only conclude that the pillar was trusting him with a confidential task he didn't want anyone else in the clan to know about. He would have been flattered, but instead, he was worried. Lan had never asked him for anything before, other than to do well at the academy. He didn't think the pillar would involve him in a secret errand for the clan, unless he had no one else he could trust to do it. On the bus, he reached into his school bag and felt the envelope, trying to guess at what was in it. It was well cushioned, but when he pushed on the bubble wrap, he could tell there were small, hard objects inside. He got off the bus and walked 10 minutes to the gate of the Call Estate. The guard waved to him as he went straight through and into the house.
Hello?
He called in the foyer. Kianla called back from the kitchen, clattering dishes.
Andinsa, is that you? Lan Zhen is in the training hall.